It's KRCU's Going Public. I'm Jacob McClelland. The world is on the cusp of a major energy transformation. What's the future for oil, coal, natural gas, nuclear, and renewable energy? On today's show, our guest is Scott Tinker. He's an energy expert at the University of Texas, and his documentary, Switch, explores where energy is headed in the future. That's ahead on Going Public. Stay tuned. Our world will undergo a major change in how we produce energy. Our dependence on traditional energy sources like oil and coal is decreasing, while we rely more on natural gas, nuclear, and renewables. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Tinker. He's a geologist at the University of Texas and the director of the Texas Bureau of Economic Geology. He also produced a documentary film called Switch. In the film, Scott Tinker talks with energy and government leaders about the challenges of our energy future. Scott Tinker, thank you so much.
It's great to be here, Jacob. Thanks.
Now, after watching Switch, the message that I get is there's really no one-size-fits-all approach that will govern our energy transformation. Rather, it's this change will be probably never see an end to coal, for instance, and see it replaced by wind power or something. It's going to be more of a subtle and nuanced switch than that, or is that kind of an oversimplification?
I think that's a reasonable description. It's a transition, for sure. Been happening for a century and continues to happen. Countries use the energy that they have. Some have coal, some have wind, some have access to oil and gas, some have better solar resources, some have great hydro. So the mix varies certainly geographically and can be accelerated away from fossil fuels in some regions and take a little bit longer in other regions.
Now, you traveled all over the world for this project. Do you have any idea how many countries you visited, and how long did this take to produce this film?
Yeah, well, I've personally been to 50 countries and have been lucky to do that, but we filmed in 11 countries for Switch. We filmed over a two-year period, and I have a day job we were working around, so it was a lot of fun. And then it was a year in post-production, and then it's been out for just about a year now in theaters around the world.
Now, you don't really take a stance of favoring one energy source over others. They all have their perks and their downside. How did the oil and gas industry, for instance, or environmentalists, how do they react to this film?
It's been fascinating. We were in about a dozen film festivals, mostly environmental film festivals. And we won the Best of Fest in Colorado. We were the opening film and the biggest one in the country up in Boston, or D.C., excuse me. So, we were embraced pretty well by the environmental community. The oil and gas community was very supportive because we didn't exclude oil and gas completely or didn't just make it a villain. And I think that community was just reasonably happy to be shown in a proper place for that form of energy. So, I would say remarkably about over 90% of our viewers have been very pleased at its objectivity, at its inclusiveness and balance. There's always going to be a few folks that are particularly enamored with a particular kind of energy, or more, they don't like a particular kind of energy, and then we'll hear from them that we're biased because we didn't like what they like enough or hate what they hate enough. but for the most part, the rest, we've gotten very, very good broad feedback. And the exciting part about that is our big vision and really our mission here is to try to bring energy, the environment, and the economy together, government, industry, and academics and NGOs together to have these discussions, which aren't simple, and begin to come to some compromises as we move forward. And that's the goal of the film and the whole project.
Looking at one of the important points of the film, coal has always been a huge part, an important part of our energy portfolio. How much of the U.S. energy portfolio comes from coal, and why does it continue to play such a large role in our electricity generation?
Well, the fundamental pillars of energy security are: is it available, is it affordable, is it reliable, and is it environmentally sustainable? And no energy is perfect. nothing matches all those, and they all have components to them. Coal is affordable, it's available, and it's reliable. It's not environmentally sustainable in the sense of actually mining in some ways and also the emissions that come from burning it. But because it meets three of the four, it continues to be used, and not just here. If you go to Asia, and China in particular, there's more coal consumed in that region, Asia, India, and the Southeast Asia, there than the rest of the world combined. So it really is a source of heat to boil water, make steam, and turn a turbine to make electricity that is tough to replace.
Is there any way to make coal clean?
Sure. You know, for many, many decades now, things have been added on into the power plants that scrub out the NOx and the SOx and the particulate matter and some of the mercury and this kind of thing. So it's the real pollutants that you would feel locally and see are being scrubbed out now in modern plants, not so much in old plants. But the last piece of that, of course, is carbon dioxide, which is an atmospheric greenhouse gas. And there are ways to scrub that out of coal power plants now, post-combustion, and better plants to build if you were going to build a new one to capture the CO2. You still have to do something with it. So the big challenge is capture, which is expensive, and then compress it and transport it and inject it into the ground and store it. All of that adds up to a lot of money, and it will take the cost of electricity up substantially. And that, you know, go back to the pillars of energy security, affordable. And that, you know, so there's this tension between can we afford it and the cost to the atmosphere.
So you can make it more environmentally sound, but the cost of coal energy then will rise
substantially.
Yeah. Is this where natural gas and hydraulic fracturing kind of enter into the energy picture? Because we've seen a huge increase in natural gas production through techniques like horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Is natural gas in some ways beginning to take the place of coal now?
Yeah, it is. Not just in some ways, it is doing that. In the United States, which is the leader in hydraulic fracturing and natural gas production associated with it, we went from, in 2004, 50% coal in terms of the fuel for electricity generation and less than 20% natural gas, so 50-20. Last year, they were about equal. Hmm. So in the low 30%, 35 each. And at plus or minus, depending on pricing, that's a remarkably fast change. As a result of that, and this is something that most people don't know, the CO2 emissions in the United States came down over the last 4 years to 1992 levels. So we've really come off. It's the fastest drop of any developed nation on Earth because of natural gas replacing coal and power plants, and also the recession took demand down. So the combination of those things, really a remarkable change. And, you know, there's some concern over hydraulic fracturing. You can go to Europe for a corollary. And, for example, Germany, a big nation there, they have a moratorium on fracking. They've put a moratorium on nuclear power after Fukushima. And, you know, unintended consequences, they are now burning more coal than they have each year successively for years, and their CO2 emissions have gone up the last 4 years. So, you know, I say, and people don't always like it, but you can't not like everything. So if you don't like fracking and you don't like nuclear, you're going to burn more coal because those are the three baseload fuels. We really have to start to think about the options and the risks associated with each. Nothing's perfect, but what it is, our biggest goals are.
Well, going back to those pillars, does natural gas really, is it pretty close to hitting all of those?
Well, it's affordable now in the U.S., but not in the rest of the world. The supplies are not nearly as robust, so it's very expensive in Europe and even more in Asia. But it's affordable here. It's available and reliable. And it's not clean. It's cleaner in terms of SOx and NOx and mercury, very little. So much better than coal there, but still has CO2 emissions, about half of coal when you combust it. And methane leaks into the atmosphere as well. So, and that's a greenhouse gas, different life length than CO2. So again, nothing's perfect. You use water to do the hydraulic fracturing, etc. So there's costs, environmental costs. It's not as good as, for example, a purely renewable energy but it's better.
Let's talk a little bit about that controversy, because that's particularly something that a lot of folks have been talking about here, especially right across the river from us in Illinois, where oil and gas companies are leasing land to tap into the New Albany Shale. Mm-hmm. A lot of the concerns are about contaminated water supplies. Is that what you have seen, that hydraulic fracturing can cause that to happen?
Well, there's the tension between data and perception in many ways, and that's very real in hydraulic fracturing, and it's real in other forms of science as well. Hydraulic fracturing itself has been going on for over half a century. The combination with a horizontal wellbore is newer, more than a decade now. You take water, compress it, and inject it to depth and crack rock. That's what it does. If it's done at depth, if you permit that to happen very close to the surface, that's silly. Okay, that's a regulator asleep. But they don't do that. They permit it to be done at depth. So 4 or 5 up to 10,000 feet, so 1 to 2 miles down. The rock doesn't crack all the way to the surface. The physics don't allow that. So the concept that you're cracking down in the hydraulic fracture itself and bringing fluids up to the groundwater has been sort of kind of misinterpreted or even mispresented in many ways. But the process of oil and gas drilling has always had surface issues. Done pretty well these days, but now and then a truck will have an accident, a tank will leak. When you produce a fluid back to the surface, if the casing that the fluid's produced through is not cemented well to the rock, through the aquifer, it can leak locally. Doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And then even when you produce the waters to the surface before you re-inject and dispose them, you can get the holding tanks or ponds there on occasion leak. So things can happen that cause local contamination of streams or groundwater. Again, it's pretty rare, and it tends to be the occasional rogue operator who isn't following permits. So what I suggest strongly is that the regulators don't let operators who are rogue operate, period, you're done, but not necessarily condemn the whole industry for something that one or two companies may do. And you can draw analogies, airlines, cruise ships, whatever, if they're not operating well and then one has a higher incidence of crashes or that kind of thing, shipwrecks, then you got to go after that particular company. But many operate very safely and take it very seriously.
Now, obviously, horizontal hydraulic fracturing uses enormous amounts of water. Are you aware of any instances of places where there have been shortages of water for human consumption or for livestock or crops due to hydraulic fracturing operations?
Yeah, it's interesting. It does use a lot. I mean, let's keep it in perspective. Give you some data from Texas briefly. Mostly here we use water for agriculture. It's a dry state, about over 60%. Another 30% is industry and cooling and various industrial uses. As you come down, about 1 to 2% is used for oil and gas total. Some of that's for water flooding. Another about 1% is for hydraulic fracturing. It's a lot of water. We use a lot of water in Texas. But proportionally, relatively, those are the percentages. The convergence of hydraulic fracturing with arid regions is where you could start to risk your freshwater systems for other kinds of use. So we have a big hydraulic fracturing play in South Texas called the Eagle Ford. It's shale oil. And down there it's arid. The groundwater is used for ranching for the most part, not much industry down there. And yes, there's going to be tension between the use of freshwater for fracking and what's needed for other kinds of activities, particularly in drought times. So we got to start thinking about ways to do hydraulic fracturing that don't use fresh water, and that is happening now in the industry. If you go over to the Marcellus Shale gas in the east, they produce all of the water from the shale. Remember, shale is a marine deposit, usually sometimes fresh water, and it contains a bunch of old ocean water. So you produce that water, and they use it and reuse it to do the fracking. And they have to add some to it, but not nearly as much as they would had they not reused it. So So this is starting to happen, Jacob, where the operators are trying to recycle and reuse the formation waters, and it reduces the amount they have to dispose and also the use of fresh water at the surface. That's a good trend.
Probably more cost-effective, I would imagine, as well.
It will be. You know, initially it was cheap to get fresh water and put other additives in it, about 1% additives. So they have to change their approaches and systems. But at the end of the day, yeah, I think you have to, depending on how saline the water is, you have to do some cleanup. But, yeah, more cost-effective in the long run because you don't have to do all of the disposal.
We've been talking today with Scott Tinker about his new documentary Switch. We'll be back in just a moment with more on the United States and the global energy future on KRCU's Going Public. It's KRCU's Going Public. I'm Jacob McClelland. I'm joined today by Scott Tinker. We're talking today about the future of our energy consumption and where our energy comes from. What are some of the benefits and some of the drawbacks to biofuels? And are we ever going to see that cellulosic ethanol made out of things like switchgrass that we've been hearing about for so many years?
Yeah. The great challenge with renewable energy in general is the challenge of energy density. So whereas nature has concentrated plants in over millions of years into liquids and gases called oil and gas, we're trying to then take plants at the surface or carbohydrates, carbon and hydrogen in one form, and convert them into hydrocarbons, carbons and hydrogens in a different form. So you grow plants, and they take a lot of acreage, and then you have to collect them and convert them into liquids. So it takes a lot of acreage, and that takes water and fertilizers and soils to do that. And then you have to go through the conversion process. So moving the plants to that facility, if you move them too far, you're actually consuming most of the liquid fuel that you'll be generating to get them there on the truck. So there's a challenge. You have to, with biofuels, you have to do it locally. It's a great supplement, I think, in places where you can use the whole plant. So the stalks and the roots and the leaves, all the cellulosic material, and convert it to a liquid. In farmland that may not be used otherwise, it has good soil, doesn't take as much rain or fertilizer, that could be a great supplement for liquid fuels and vehicles. It'll be difficult, and we interviewed one of the top experts in the world in the film, to have it ever replace oil. So, again, a good supplement, but just a volumetrically challenge to become scalable.
Where do renewable energies like solar and wind and geothermal, where do they fit into this big energy change that we're seeing on the horizon?
Well, they've been growing. Again, they're a low density or distributed form of energy. The wind blows in some places and the sun is everywhere when it's sunny. You got to convert that or condense it into a dense form of energy that we like to use. Electricity. They have a great role in the future. I show them growing substantially into the future. A lot of technology, a lot of infrastructure to grab it at low density and convert it. That can be done. When you go to scale with anything, there are challenges. The biggest challenge with solar, and I don't want to lump them, they have different challenges partly. With solar and wind is their intermittency. So when the wind is not blowing, we still need electricity, and we use it in real time, so you have to have something to back it up when the sun's not shining. And it doesn't shine at night, you know, it doesn't shine when it's cloudy, so you have to have something to back it up. The big technological breakthrough that could change the world of energy is storage. If we could store energy in an available and affordable and scalable way, then we will change the world because now I can capture the wind's motion when it's blowing, even if I don't need it then, and store it. I can capture the sun when it's sunny and store it, even if I don't need it then, and then use it later. So it removes the intermittency. And there are big challenges in storing energy, as we know. Lots of folks are starting to work on that. But that will be one of those black swan moments or accelerating moments when the transition can go very rapidly if we begin to crack that nut.
Is that one of the similar drawbacks with electric cars, for instance, the battery power, having enough storage space for energy to do your regular travels the way that you would with fossil fuels?
It is. A chemical battery is heavy and large, so it takes up room. You don't get the distance out of it that you're used to, it's okay. You know, if you're doing local driving, you may have one electric and one other. And then the battery, if I were to leave a big battery vehicle at the airport for a month, let's say, you would lose some of that energy. You know how your cell phone is, just sitting there, as opposed to a gas tank, a gasoline tank, which you cap it up and there it sits. So, you know, one of the big challenges is efficiency, storing that energy efficiently in an electric vehicle. And it does use chemicals. You have a large set of batteries then. You have to either refurbish and recycle and then dispose of eventually the shell and the cost. You know, if I take we drove a Tesla Roadster in the film, which was a lot of fun, by the way.
It looked like a lot of fun, yeah.
If you've never driven a fully electric car, you got to, because it's a completely different experience. There are no gears, so it doesn't shift. It's fantastic. You know, it feels like the drivetrain of the future. But the battery in that little sports car was 1,000 pounds and 7,000 lithium-ion batteries the size of my finger. And to replace it, which happens every 6 to 8 years, is $30,000. So people say, wow, you know, that's like buying another car. Now, that's a sports car, but that's a very big battery. That gets you that 200 to 250-mile range, which folks want. And to get that with today's technology is very expensive. Things continue to improve, but there are some kind of scientific or kinetic and thermodynamic limits to how much you can get out of a chemical battery, and we continue to improve it, but it can only go so far.
Now, you open your film by visiting a hydroelectric power plant in Norway. This is really quite striking because Norway produces almost all of its energy through this plant, and it's underground, and there's no dam there. How does this work, and why can't everybody have one?
Well, as they said, you should move to Norway. They have tremendous topography. You know, Norway has beautiful fjords and topography and rainfall that's common, so the water, you need gravity. Water flows down a hill. In this case, they hollow out a cave under a mountain, drop it through a pipe, so it accelerates the water and spins a turbine and out into a fjord. So, and then it rains and takes it back up and repeat. So that's perfect situation for hydro. Parts of South America have a similar situation with the Andes mountain chain. Wherever you have topography and rainfall, you can do these kinds of things, but unfortunately, many of us are missing one or the other or both of those things. So it's not as easy to do hydro when it's flat or when there's not much rain. We've used most of the dams, the big dam sites in the world. The other way to do hydro, of course, is to pump the water up the hill and flow it down when you need it. And that's one of the options being explored for energy storage. Again, you lose energy when you do that. It costs more energy to pump it up than you get when you flow it back down. But if you're gathering energy from a wind turbine or a solar panel when it's not needed and pumping the water, then you use it when it flows down. So it's in a time efficiency sort of scenario.
And we've been talking about all of these different energy sources, and we haven't even talked about nuclear, which is an important energy source here in the United States and worldwide. You visited France, for instance, to visit a nuclear power plant there. Why France? Why was that the country that you chose to visit to talk about nuclear?
Well, France gets 80% of their electricity from nuclear, and they did it by necessity. They didn't have many options, so they decided to go full nuclear for their electric generation. And they've done it very well. They only have about half the reactors that the U.S. has. We have a big nuclear fleet here. It's older, but France made the commitment. So we went there and we looked at not only their reactors, but their reprocessing facility. So they take the waste, not just from France, around Europe. They recycle and reprocess it. So depleted uranium comes in, they re-enrich the uranium and send it back out to be used again. And this is a very positive thing for France because the actual solid waste is less intense and less volume, and they can reuse that energy. They do it again out of necessity because it's more expensive for them to buy new uranium than to recycle their old uranium. A great system. Works very well for France. A lot of the world is looking at nuclear. China's building 29 new reactors today. Saudi Arabia's got reactors on the books. India. And even in the U.S., we've permitted 4 new reactors on brownfield sites just in the past year to try to move that forward a bit.
How about energy conservation? Instead of producing more energy, why not just use less or use it more efficiently?
Well, we should. You know, there's, and that if you really get down to the underlying message of switch is the switch in the way we think about energy. So we can begin to change the way we use it, use it more efficiently, use less, conserve, recognize that it's just not something that's there for free, and it's a precious resource. So that's the real switch, and we can do tremendous things in terms of efficiency. And a lot of it, Jacob, won't even change your lifestyle. You know, you wouldn't notice these things in terms of, hey, I'm really having to make a substantive change in the way I live. But I'm sitting talking with you in my office right now, and there aren't any lights on. There's one lamp. I don't need a bunch of lights. We're used to them, but we don't need them. And it's just an example of the cultural change that needs to happen as we transition into the future. That said, we can't conserve our way out of any future energy crisis. We're going to use energy as the population grows and nations industrialize. But we can sure use less and continue to do the same kinds of things we do now.
We've been talking today with Dr. Scott Tinker. He's a geologist at the University of Texas and the director of the Texas Bureau of Economic Geology. And he also produced the documentary film Switch. Dr. Tinker, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It's been great. Thanks, and good luck with everything you do.
Thank you for joining us today for Going Public. If you have questions or comments, please email us at comments@krcu.org. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KRCU or its licensee. I'm Jacob McClelland. Thanks for listening.